This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks. Most people who live in Boston will tell you that things in the city are better than they were 20 years ago. It's safer, cleaner, the economy better positioned for the 21st century.
So a natural conclusion to draw would be that fewer people are poor in Boston. But it turns out that is not true at all. Poverty is just as bad, if not worse, depending on how you look at it. Meanwhile, the gap between rich and poor has widened enormously along with the rest of the country.
And that despite the city and state's nationally reputed commitment to social policies that are supposed to mitigate problems like this. So here to go deep with us on some fascinating and frankly disturbing numbers about our city is Paul Grogan, president of the Boston Foundation. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Paul.
Thanks, Adam. Good to be here.
So the Boston Foundation has produced this new report about income inequality, and people can find it at radioboston.org. It's looking largely at how things have changed over the last 20 years, 1990 to now, and the crudest measure of poverty in Boston, the number of people living below the federal poverty line, has remained essentially flat, just under 20% or so. But that's not the whole story, right? There have been major shifts within that 20%. If you could just first explain how the demographic composition of that number has changed.
Well, essentially, the white portion of it has dropped enormously. White poverty has been cut in half over that 20-year period. And if you've had tremendous growth in populations of color. So while the poverty rate has stayed the same, the people that we're talking about are actually quite a bit different. And as you say, the Boston has had really a couple of great decades for a city, a tremendous renaissance that's been recognized around the world, but not everybody's participating.
Talk about the geographic distribution of that 20%.
It's very heavily concentrated in three neighborhoods of the city, Roxbury, Mattapan, and Dorchester. Those the poverty rate there is 42% for children.
42% for children.
That's right. The single-parent households dominate. Over 90% of the households in poverty have a single parent, usually a female, but occasionally a male. So we've got those neighborhoods have been poor neighborhoods for a while, but the concentration of poverty has deepened. There's no question about that.
And while the total official federal poverty number for Boston has stayed essentially flat, the cost of living in Boston has risen. Now, obviously, the federal policy poverty threshold has risen, too, but has the cost of living here outpaced that?
Considerably. And so what that says is that these numbers actually mask a larger problem because of the difference between the rate at which the poverty standard has gone up and the rate of inflation.
Yeah, what kind of indicators do you look at for cost of living?
Well, it's the Women's Self-Sufficiency Project that Crittenden Women's Union piloted looks at, basic household things, food, housing, things of that nature. And unfortunately, what's compounding all this is we have a very high cost of living in this part of the country, high housing costs, high energy costs, the highest health care costs in the nation. So that really puts a lot of families behind the eight ball.
And I want to remind the listeners what the federal poverty thresholds are. For a person living alone, it's $10,830. Family of two, $14,570. Family of six, $29,530. That's total annual household income. So imagine trying to house six people in Boston for $30,000 a year. If you're doing that, the government says you're not poor.
Well, and right. And the overwhelming majority of those folks are renters. And we know that rental costs in the Boston housing market are higher than they've ever been.
But of course, as you mentioned, Boston is a much more vibrant place than it was 20 years ago. Does the fact that poverty has stayed flat or gotten worse, depending on how you look at it, tell us that things have gotten better solely as a function of the well-off in Boston getting more well-off?
Well, I don't think we fully know the answer to that with this report. Professor Ed Glaser at Harvard has a wonderful new book called The Triumph of the City.
Sure, yeah.
Asserts in that book that the levels of poverty are not a way to measure how things are going in a city because poor people do gravitate to cities for economic opportunity, and he says that's a good thing. The question is, what is happening to those people once they arrive? Are they getting on some kind of an escalator like we'd like to believe this country still has for hardworking people, or are they trapped there? I think things like the number of single-parent households and the poor, generally poor performance of these low-income kids in school would indicate that a fair number are getting trapped in poverty, and that's the real problem we have to address.
Listeners, we're talking about who is poor in Boston today and what it means to be poor. This new report from the Boston Foundation indicates that overall poverty in the city is flat over the last 20 years, but really everything within that number has changed. We'd love to hear from some callers. Do you think of yourself as poor? Are you surprised to find yourself that way in a city as relatively prosperous as Boston? Is there anything that you're hearing here in these findings that surprises you? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Paul Grogan from the Boston Foundation, the big economic indicators in Boston and more broadly in Massachusetts are very positive compared with the rest of the nation. We have lower unemployment. The average wage is higher. We've found a way to get health insurance to almost everybody, problematic as it may be. Educational attainment is higher, and yet this income gap remains, and we have just as many, if not really just as many, if not more, really poor people than we did in 1990. So in broad strokes, tell us what you think is going on here.
Well, part of this is the underside of Boston's great success. We've created a so-called knowledge economy here, and that's been a big part of the city's renaissance. And what that means is the jobs are in higher education, healthcare, technology, finance, most of which require a post-secondary degree of some kind. And so if you have those credentials, you're probably doing very, very well. Right. But the other side of the coin is this is an economy that punishes those that don't have those credentials. And so that's why the level of inequality in Boston is one of the highest anywhere in the country. But we wouldn't want to not have had the success we've had, but we've got to do a much better job equipping a larger portion of the population to get into the economic mainstream and compete for those jobs.
Also with us in the studio right now, we have Tiziana Deering, formerly the head of Catholic Charities of Boston. And for the last year, she's been running a startup called Boston Rising, which is this novel anti-poverty fund that's been focusing on Grove Hall. Tiziana, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Same question to you. What's going on?
Well, it's a mobility question. I think Paul's right about that. And he's also right to say we want the growth, right? We want prosperity. We want the city to have a renaissance over 20 years. But, I mean, a real question of sort of the American proposition is can everyone participate in that? And what we're discovering is that there are real barriers to kind of participating in the American dream, depending on things like the zip code where you're born and your race. And that cannot be an acceptable thing for the American proposition.
Let's talk about the model that you're experimenting with at Boston Rising. You've put together some private and some foundation money, and you've started forming these things called neighbor circles in Grove Hall. Explain that.
Well, neighbor circles is one of the things that we're working with. We happily borrowed that model from Lawrence Community Works in Lawrence, Massachusetts, where they're doing some amazing work. Neighbor circles are based on the concept that one of the things that you need to rise, right, to participate in the American dream, kind of chart your path, decide what you want for yourself and your family and do it. One of the things that you need is some strong social networks. We talk a lot today about social networking and online, and we think about that for fairly privileged people.
Sure.
But basic social networks are part of how we make our way. It's that person who tells you about a job or who helps you in a moment of crisis.
And it's because of that fact that the concentration of poverty that the Boston Foundation study is documenting is especially problematic, right?
Well, I think it's problematic and it's self-fulfilling. The more isolated you are, the more isolated you are. And part of what neighbor circles does is introduce people to literally to their neighbors. Let's have some dinners together. Let's figure out where we came from. Let's tell each other our stories. Let's figure out what we think about our community. And maybe there's some stuff we want to do together.
So you go in, you just knock on doors and you get everybody together?
Well, so we organize a group of people who go out and knock on each other's doors.
I see.
The agency's important here, right? It's not we knock on doors, we get everybody together. It's you give people in a community an opportunity to knock on each other's doors and get everybody together. And in that distinction is a magnitude of difference.
So that's step one at Boston Rising. What's step two?
So there are many other steps that we can take. We think there are three building blocks to this, right? You need an education that's actually going to give you a shot at a job. Then you need a shot at a job. And you need a few social networks along the way. So let's talk about next phases. People closest to poverty need some access and control of resources in order to fight it, right, in order to figure out what they need to rise. One of the things we've done is established the Grove Hall Trust. We've taken $250,000, sequestered it, and made it available to a trustee group of residents and people who work in Grove Hall. They have complete control over those resources to decide how they want to invest them, what the priorities are, what the size should be, et cetera.
So sort of become your own – here's a neighborhood. Become your own grant-making organization for
yourself. Set your priorities. Let's put some choice and control back in the hands of people who are experiencing this trap. Have faith in them, for God's sake, right? Yeah. And let them set some priorities about what matters locally.
Let's go to some calls. Susan's calling from Watertown. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling because, the question was intriguing. You were asking, do you consider yourself poor or impoverished? And I absolutely do. I'm married. I have a great job. My husband does contract work. We have two kids. But we rent a place in Watertown, and I'm sure from the outside people look at us and think, they're renting a nice apartment, they drive a car, they both have jobs, they work. But I consider us poor. I mean, we are struggling to save every day, and I absolutely believe it's the cost of living in this area, and we are really, we've been sort of wrestling with the idea of moving for years, and we've never pulled the trigger because we both think that we have, really decent jobs, but it's like we're just not moving ahead. And now that we have two kids, we wonder if we're going to be able to pay for them in the future. So,
yeah, it seems like it's a trap that you seem to hear about a lot in the nation broadly right now. People who, in order to live in a place where they can get a job, have to live in a place that they can't afford with that job.
That's exactly how we feel. If we move somewhere else, will we receive the same amount of, the same salary or the same amount of compensation? The work that we do, we just think that we won't. So, but we're just really stuck right now. We're just thinking, oh gosh, what do we do with these two kids? Do we raise them here, or move wherever? And I don't work anymore. And my husband works all the time. I mean, it's really kind of a struggle.
Yeah, I understand, Susan, and I appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
Well, the report points out that there are far more people than those below the poverty line who are really struggling, as is this caller. In fact, another 340,000 people in Boston are experiencing this kind of stress and uncertainty and are maybe one setback or disaster away from falling into poverty. And I think this is a national phenomenon that really has to awaken our leaders, because it has been so central to the success of this country, not just the access to the middle class, but people's belief that they can get there. And if we lose that, I think we will lose a great deal that has been special about this country.
Well, considering how out of whack the federal poverty standards are, and all of the benefits, eligibilities that are associated with them are with the cost of living in the Boston area, as we just heard from Susan, does the Boston Foundation's research here indicate that more localized poverty interventions like the ones that Tiziana is working on, are those the way of the future?
I certainly hope so, and we're encouraged at the revisions in the in how income is calculated have been done. The old standard left out public benefits, but it also didn't count such things as medical expenses. And so we're moving toward a more realistic picture, but ultimately that's got to the regional differences in cost are so huge that we're advocating very strongly for their for a factor.
Let's take one more call. Torley is calling from Roxbury. Hi, Torley.
Hey, Torley Crowell right here. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling us. So we were just sort of asking people if they felt poor, and if so, why, and are you surprised? How do you answer that question?
I am not surprised at all. I'm a refugee that came to this country for the past 20 years, have lived in Roxbury, worked to get young people educated and to get refugees to get adjusted to life here. There is systemic discrimination, endemic systemic discrimination against people, even people who come here with a high qualification from other countries. There's discrimination widespread in nonprofit, in the business sector, and even in the religious sector, and it has become impossible for people to make it.
Torley, let's pick that up. Tiziana, I mean, I guess what Torley is sort of identifying, or at least arguing on one side of it, is the sort of chicken and egg question about whether or not the fact that poverty is concentrated in among certain neighborhoods and certain populations is causative rather than correlative.
Mm-hmm.
What as being someone who works in doing what you do, What do you think is going on there?
Well, listen, you know, one of the things that I welcome about Turley's column, also about the report, is sooner or later we have to talk about race and poverty.
Yeah.
I mean, we just have to. We have to talk about race and poverty. When you take a set of communities that are predominantly or have the highest concentrations of minority residents and you say that 42% of their children are living in poverty, we have to talk about race and poverty. We have to talk about history of structural imbalances. We have to talk openly about where discrimination does and doesn't exist. And we have to decide that all kids are our kids, and we want all kids and all families to have a real shot at rising.
Well, but one of the more difficult findings that Paul Grogan talks about is that of Boston families with children who are living in poverty, 85% are headed by a single parent. What do you think that tells us about the problem here and how we solve it?
Well, I think the single parent trend is a lot bigger than in these families and households. I think we have a single parent trend in the United States. And I think part of what that moves us toward is understanding. Listen, one of the worst things I think that Hillary Clinton ever did was write a book called It Takes a Village, because it kind of took that phrase out of, you know, it's a politicized phrase now. If you say it, you mean like 800 things, right? But
right.
I don't mean 800 things. I mean it takes lots of adults to raise kids, and it takes community. And what we have to solve today is how we keep adults in kids' lives, how we enfranchise families with schools and schools back with families, how we enfranchise communities, and together we raise kids and create conditions where people can rise.
Paul, the problem of single-family households as you see it through this data?
Again, this is a very, very sensitive issue. I can imagine conservatives reacting to this report. You know, if you get married and stay married, you probably won't be poor. And liberals saying things like, well, you know, the economic opportunities available, for instance, to black men are so poor that is really what's affecting this. And it's a tangle. But again, what we hope with this report is that we put some things out there. And as Tiziana says, we've got to start talking about these things more than we have.
Well, this report that you've put out here sort of winds up by looking at cuts to social services that we've seen in Massachusetts in response to the budget constraints of recent years. And you guys really kind of come out and argue that these cuts will cost us a lot of money in the long term. Could you give us an example, Paul?
Well, there are all sorts of programs. I mean, just to relate it to the single parent, teenage pregnancy prevention programs at the state have been cut 41% in the last few years. You know, the asymmetry between what we need to do and the priorities is enormous. You know, food stamps, women, infants, and children. There are a whole set of safety net programs for which there is now greater demand that have been cut already and are likely to be cut more because of the federal process, which under any scenario looks like discretionary federal spending is going to be cut.
Right. A lot of these things were being sort of propped up by stimulus spending for the last couple of years.
That's right. And a big problem here is health care costs. The out of control spiral of increase of Medicaid and public employee health care costs are squeezing state budgets severely. Health care has gone up 76% in the last decade while we've cut public higher education, public health, environment and recreation programs. So in addition to everything else, the health care costs are kind of crowding out investments in a better tomorrow that we need to make.
You know, this is a framing of prevention versus detention. And in most cases, the preventive approach versus the detention or response approach is less expensive. It costs a lot less to educate a child for a year than to incarcerate that person as an adult.
There are some stunning things in this chart at the back of this report, Paul. You know, for every dollar spent on Head Start, it's been found to save $7 to $9 in future public costs. Where are you getting those numbers
right.
from?
Well, you know, the data is well known. Some of them are recent university studies, government data, census data. And even though it's well known that prevention can save a lot of money, we don't really have the accounting systems to capture the savings and verify them and apply them to budgets. And so we're in this cycle once again of trying to make balanced budgets by cutting these programs, and they're going to be cut to the bone. So in the short run, things are quite likely to get worse.
I'm sure that there are a lot of listeners who are out there who are hearing all of this and thinking, okay, you know, do what you want with social interventions, but ultimately it comes back to the economy and whether or not there are jobs for low and moderate skilled workers. In fact, here's Diana Limbach-Temple tweeting at us at Radio Boston. Boston's innovation economy doesn't benefit everyone. We need good education and community programs and jobs. I'm just adding on jobs for low to moderately skilled people. How do we do that in 30 seconds or less, guys?
Well, one of the things we have to do is get people qualified for the jobs that exist. Even today, many employers are reporting in Massachusetts they cannot find qualified workers for these so-called middle-income jobs, and we've got to get the high school graduation and college completion rates up to get those jobs.
Yeah, we got to drive readiness. I mean, I heard a statistic today that 40% of companies that have jobs posted have had them posted longer than 6 months. That means there's just a huge gap between what's available and what people are ready to do. We can work on that. That's doable.
New report on poverty from the Boston Foundation is available at radioboston.org. Paul Grogan from the Boston Foundation, thanks so much for coming in and talking about it.
Thank you.
And Tiziana Deering, CEO of Boston Rising. We'll look forward to seeing how you guys do in your next few years.
Thanks very much.
Stay with us, listeners. Up next, the often gruesome history of surgery in Boston. I'm Adam Ragusa with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.